You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
The first was, of course, President Obama's speech in Prague, setting out the goal of the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. And then the second is the ongoing nuclear posture review. And there's a lot of difficult, thorny issues that have to be tackled. And what I wanted to do today was invite a couple of guests in to discuss two of the difficultest and thorniest issues that need to be worked through. The first of those issues is the circumstances under which the United States reserves the right to use nuclear weapons. As many as you know, historically, the US has actually kept quite a wide variety of circumstances in which it holds out the option to use nuclear weapons. And those have been summarized as deter, defeat, dissuade, and assure. And there's a debate about them at the moment. About whether the U.S. should narrow those circumstances, perhaps going so far as to say that the U.S. maintains nuclear weapons only to deter the use of nuclear weapons from others. Some would go even further and add the word only into that sentence. The U.S. only maintains nuclear weapons to deter nuclear weapons of others. And some would go even further and actually have a no-first-use pledge. So that's one of the issues that we're going to look at today. The other issue is the vexed subject of extended deterrence. Perhaps the one fact about extended deterrence that everybody can agree on is that it's much easier to deter your enemies than it is to assure your adversaries. But this gap between assurance and deterrence opens up a fascinating question. If the US has capabilities which it feels it doesn't need anymore to deter an adversary, should it retain those capabilities simply for the sake of assuring an ally? And that's the issue that Jeffrey Lewis is going to look at today. I'm going to introduce both speakers now to save breaking up the flow of this afternoon's talks with another introduction. So speaking on the subject of no first use, to my right is Mike Gerson. Mike, at the moment, is a research analyst at the Center for Naval Analyses. Mike gets quite a lot of hands-on experience of deterrence policy because quite a lot of his time for CNA is spent in the Pentagon giving advice to the U.S. Navy on deterrence policy. He's been involved in a number of studies, including the Navy's new maritime strategy, a cooperative strategy for 21st century sea power. Mike's published widely in the area of nuclear weapons and deterrence, and he was an undergraduate at the University of Texas and a graduate student at the University of Chicago. To my left is Dr. Jeffrey Lewis, who will be familiar, I think, to many of you. Jeffrey has become one of the most distinctive voices in nuclear policy over the last few years. Contrary to popular belief, he's not a physicist, though the fact that many people think he is, I think, is a testament to the quality of the technical analysis that he puts up on his blog, Arms Control Wonk. In addition to the blog, he's also the author of a number of articles and one book on China's nuclear policy called Minimum Means of Reprisal. He was formerly the executive director of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard University and has a PhD from down the road at the University of Maryland. While unquestionably not his best achievement, I think the achievement that Jeffrey is probably secretly proudest of is becoming a global services member with United, which for those of you who do a lot of flying is the level above 1K. He got that far largely through spending a lot of time over the past 2 years flying around the world talking to US allies about extended deterrence, which is his particular qualification for speaking on that subject today. So that's quite enough from me. And so to open up by discussing the issue of no first use, it's my pleasure to introduce Mike Gerson.
Thanks, James. I want to thank the Carnegie Endowment and the Nonproliferation Program for the invitation, and a personal thanks to James, who is not only a good friend but a tremendous colleague and has been a tremendous source of advice and encouragement and support throughout the time he's been here, and particularly with this project. So thank you, James. I should also clarify that Jeffrey's not a physicist. I'm also not the President Bush's former speechwriter. We have no relation as far as I'm concerned, politically or otherwise. What I want to do today is examine whether the United States should retain the option to use nuclear weapons first. It's common knowledge in this community, in the nuclear weapons community, in the nonproliferation community, that the United States has sort of always had the option to be the first to initiate the use of nuclear weapons in conflict, although I would suspect that most Americans who don't follow these issues would probably be surprised by the fact that the United States still retains the option to use nuclear weapons first. In fact, we could argue that the nuclear age began with the first use of nuclear weapons by the United States, and we've essentially retained that option ever since. And what's interesting about this is that despite all of the changes in the international security environment, and despite all of the calls for revising nuclear policy, revising our nuclear force posture, this fundamental continuity, the threat to use nuclear weapons first, still remains, and I think needs to be reexamined in light of today's challenges. To some extent, President Obama kickstarted this effort by, in his Prague speech on April 5th, announcing that we would seek to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. national security strategy. This has raised a bit of an issue because the question is a sort of what does reduce role mean? It's not quite clear what the role of nuclear weapons is or what it should be or what reduce the role means. From my perspective, if we can all agree that nuclear weapons are for deterrence, the fundamental question is what are we going to deter? And therefore, from that perspective, when I think about reducing the role, I think of narrowing the number of things that the United States might deter with nuclear weapons, narrowing the number of things we say nuclear weapons are for. So the focus of my talk today is to lay out the case for the United States to adopt a policy of the no first use of nuclear weapons. Such a policy would say something to the effect of the sole purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons is to deter and, if necessary, respond to the use of nuclear weapons on the United States, its allies, its territories, and or its forces abroad. Such a policy would, of course, restrict U.S. nuclear weapons to deterring only the use of nuclear weapons. We would not use nuclear weapons to the threat of the implicit or explicit threat of nuclear weapons to deter chemical and biological attacks or conventional attacks. Nuclear weapons would solely be used to deter other nuclear attacks. Just by way of a brief background, no first use has been a constant feature of the nuclear age. Proposals for the United States to adopt a policy of this sort has been around for quite a while. In the Cold War, probably the most important example of this was an article in the spring 1982 issue of Foreign Affairs entitled Nuclear Weapons and the Atlantic Alliance. In some ways, before the current four horsemen on nuclear abolition, there was what was called at the time the Gang of Four, which was George Bundy, George Kennan, Robert McNamara, and Gerard Smith, who in this article in the spring 82 issue of Foreign Affairs advocated that NATO should adopt a policy of the no first use of nuclear weapons. The focus of their argument, just very briefly, was that NATO had always relied on the threat of nuclear first use to deter a large-scale conventional attack. And their argument was is nobody had put forth a reliable or effective way to control nuclear war once the threshold had been crossed. And if no one could reliably or effectively control a nuclear war once that threshold had been crossed, there must be serious doubts about a policy that relied upon such a threat. The counterargument of this, of course, was that taking away the option to escalate to nuclear use would make conventional war more likely by giving the Soviets this potential advantage to capitalize on their numerical superiority. That was the sort of Cold War argument. The end of the Cold War brought forth a new set of arguments. Those in favor of no first use argued that the demise of the Warsaw Pact conventional threat in Europe, coupled with significant advancements in U.S. conventional capabilities, most notably precision-guided munitions, allowed for the United States to essentially reserve nuclear weapons only for deterring nuclear attacks. This kind of argument and proposals for no first use, there was a massive flurry of articles in the early to mid-90s. The Canberra Commission on the Elimination of Nuclear Weapons advocated no first use. The National Academy of Sciences report on the future of U.S. nuclear weapons policy advocated no first use. Again, along these lines that the major conventional threat had disappeared, therefore we didn't need to rely on the threat of nuclear weapons to bolster deterrence of a conventional attack. Moreover, the conventional capability, U.S. conventional superiority, demonstrated so well in the first Gulf War, made it such that conventional capabilities were absolutely sufficient for deterrence. Even Paul Nitze, one of the architects of NSC 68 in 1994, asked, is it time to junk our nukes? His argument was smart conventional weapons should be the principal U.S. deterrent. They're safer, they cause less collateral damage, they provide more flexibility, there's less risk of escalation, and perhaps most importantly, they're highly credible. So people who had once concocted rather elaborate scenarios for nuclear war fighting came around to this view that smart conventional weapons could be the principal deterrent. Whereas those in favor of no first use advocated one set of views. There was another set of counterarguments. Whereas in the Cold War, the counterargument to no first use was that it would make conventional war more likely. Those conceded that in some ways conventional war was not the right issue. However, we still needed the threat to use nuclear weapons first to deter chemical and especially biological attacks. This was the principal argument against no first use, and it continues to be one of the principal arguments. This policy of retaining the option to use no first to retain the option to use nuclear weapons was necessary for a policy of calculated ambiguity. In 98, Defense Secretary Cohen said, "We think that the ambiguity involved in the issue of nuclear weapons contributes to our own security, keeping any potential adversary who might use either chemical or biological unsure of what our response would be. We think that is a sound doctrine." In essence, calculated ambiguity is seen by its proponents as kind of being the best of both worlds. The United States gets the deterrent benefits of holding out the option to respond with nuclear weapons, while at the same time committing itself to nothing if deterrence fails. Another argument for retaining the option to use nuclear weapons first, in addition to the deter chemical and biological, which is really the sort of most fundamental, is that simply leaving open this option, keeping adversaries unsure of what our response might be, creates an incalculable risk. And so today, the fundamental debate on the issue of declaratory policy is really one between calculated ambiguity, on the one hand, essentially maintaining what we have, or switching to something more specific like no first use. And so the debate is between those who want to keep all options open and those who want to restrict our options. As I said before, the principal argument since the end of the Cold War for no first use has been that the threat of nuclear weapons is essentially unnecessary to deter anything but nuclear weapons. The argument is that conventional superiority provides sufficient punishment and denial capabilities to deter conventional attack as well as chemical and biological attacks. I agree that it's unnecessary, and I'll be happy if you want in Q&A to discuss a little bit more about why I think it's unnecessary. But what I want to argue is that retaining the option to use nuclear weapons first is not only unnecessary, but also potentially dangerous. In arguing for no first use, proponents of the policy have not paid enough attention in their arguments to the risks of calculated ambiguity, and that's sort of what I want to focus on today. So thus, my argument stands in contrast to those who believe that the more options, the better, and that ambiguity aids deterrence by creating uncertainty and incalculable risks. My argument comes from a position that a fundamental tenet of deterrence is that limiting your options can, in fact, enhance deterrence and make you safer. This notion of deliberately tying one's hands or limiting one's options is, of course, attributed to the work of Tom Schelling, who argued that limiting one's own options could be a commitment tactic to enhance the credibility of one's threats. Examples in this context are, you know, burning a bridge, having your army cross, and then burning the bridge so one could not retreat. Or more importantly, making your commitments public. By making statements public, in fact, becomes a commitment tactic by increasing the cost to you of going back. The example is, if you're going to go on a diet, one of the best ways to make sure you actually keep on that diet is to tell everybody you know that you're going on the diet. So that's the sort of position that I come from, is that while the traditional view has been that as many options as possible is the best way to go, and in some ways the military thinks that way, in part because their job is to put military options in the toolbox of national power, what I want to argue is that limiting U.S. options to use nuclear weapons first by declaring a no-first-use policy will, in fact, make us safer. My argument is essentially this. Nuclear first use is one of two things. It's either not credible, in which case it adds nothing to U.S. security but is complicating politically in the non-proliferation context, or if it is credible, it's potentially dangerous by fostering crisis instability. So I'm going to talk a few more minutes about that. On the one hand, I think you can make a case that U.S. threats, whether they're implicit or explicit, and really what we're talking about here is the ambiguous threat, is simply not credible. It's not credible for a variety of reasons. I mean, one is the nuclear taboo, this moral and political aversion to using nuclear weapons that has emerged in the long absence of nuclear use and conflict. In the nuclear arena, the United States is largely seen as cool-headed, risk-averse, and sensitive to casualties and collateral damage. The United States does not seem to be able to benefit from the sort of rationality of irrationality-type arguments. The prospect that the United States would unilaterally shatter the almost seven-decade record of non-use in conflict, I think, contributes to the belief that the United States would, in fact, not use nuclear weapons. Another argument is I think that one could make the case that an unintended consequence of the United States' first use of the United States' efforts to lead the global non-proliferation regime is that it reduces the credibility of the United States to use nuclear weapons first. If the United States spends all this time working on the efforts to prevent others from getting nuclear weapons, it seems it makes it less credible that the United States would risk shattering that and throwing it all away by using nuclear weapons first. And finally, in the Gulf War, you know, despite the threats of calculated ambiguity and the ambiguous threat of nuclear weapons, which some believe deterred Saddam, Bush, Scowcroft, Powell, and Baker all said after the conflict that they had actually never intended on using nuclear weapons. And such public admission, I think, reduces the credibility of those threats. Now, on the other side, I think that retaining the option to use nuclear weapons first is dangerous. Retaining the option, particularly against adversaries with small nuclear capabilities, generates crisis instability and preemption incentives, especially against adversaries with inferior capabilities. Crisis stability is, I think, a useful lens through which to look at issues today, because if nuclear weapons are used, in my view, it's not going to be a bolt from the blue. It's going to be in the context of a severe political and military crisis, and therefore crisis stability becomes an appropriate lens through which to view nuclear dynamics. Essentially, crisis stability refers to incentives to preempt and strike first in a crisis. A crisis is said to be stable if neither side has an incentive to strike first, and both know that. And a crisis is said to be unstable if one or both sides has a real or perceived incentive to preempt. So in other words, the essence of crisis instability is the fear of the other's first strike and how that may motivate you to strike first in order to prevent the advantages that one might seek. This has been traditionally an argument associated with the 1960s and with sort of McNamara and left-leaning academics, but in fact, this view actually took hold beforehand and was so prominent among some members of the military. For example, General Leslie Groves, who was the military leader of the Manhattan Project, said in 1957, if Russia knows we won't attack first, the Kremlin will be very much less apt to attack us. Our reluctance to strike first is a military disadvantage to us, but it is also, paradoxically, a factor in preventing world conflict today. So from the perspective of crisis instability, retaining the option to use nuclear weapons first, even if ambiguous, essentially the all-options-on-the-table approach, is essentially dangerous because it generates fear of a U.S. disarming first strike in an intense crisis and thereby increases the chances that nuclear weapons are used accidentally, inadvertently, or deliberately. There are essentially three pathways. I think there's probably more, but I would argue that there are essentially three pathways in which you may get nuclear use through crisis instability. In other words, adversaries' fear of a U.S. disarming first strike. First, the fear of a U.S. first strike could prompt an opponent to adopt a launch-on-warning posture, disperse its forces rapidly and haphazardly, raise alert levels, and perhaps even pre-delegate launch authority to ensure launch, even if command and control apparatus are severed. This rapid dispersion in the heat of an intense crisis increases the chances that of accidental or unauthorized use of nuclear weapons. And so the fear of a U.S. first strike in an intense crisis generates all these incentives to disperse forces, to make them more survivable, to ensure some sort of retaliation, and that increases the chances that they, in fact, may be used accidentally or in an unauthorized way. A second sort of pathway is the fear of a U.S. first strike prompts a state that is concerned about the survivability of its forces to disperse those forces, to raise alert levels, to erect its TELs if it has mobile missile launchers. And that leads to a misinterpretation, whereas they perceive their efforts as signaling resolve to the United States and reducing vulnerability of their forces. The United States misinterprets such actions as the sign of an impending launch, and we preempt. So that's a situation in which we walk ourselves into preemption through miscalculation. I think a third pathway is that the fear of a U.S. first strike creates a use-it-or-lose-it dynamic. This is a situation in which nuclear weapons are used deliberately. The use-it-or-lose-it dynamic is also characterized, I think, as a now-or-never possibility. It's we've got nuclear weapons now, but we may not be able to use them later. There are essentially two mechanisms that may cause use-it-or-lose-it dynamics. The first is a first strike out of desperation. In this situation, the adversary is compelled to strike to avert what it perceives as an even greater disaster if it doesn't, which is the elimination of its nuclear weapons and a subsequent conventional war and perhaps even regime change. In this case, the adversary's use of nuclear weapons is less to achieve something positive, but rather than to mitigate disaster, however slightly, As one author put it, vulnerability could prove a temptation or a goad to strike quickly, not so much out of any belief that it would do much good, but because it appeared that waiting could only be worse. Similarly, Schelling argued the decision to attack might be made reluctantly, motivated not by the prospective gains of victory, but by the disadvantages of not seizing the initiative. That's one mechanism. A second mechanism is whereby the adversary believes that its nuclear capability provides it sort of a trump card against a U.S. attack or invasion. If an adversary believes that nuclear weapons provide a mechanism of de-escalation, whereby the use of nuclear weapons is used to coerce the United States into a negotiated settlement, it may believe that it basically has to do this earlier than it wanted, because if it waits, it may lose its nuclear capability and therefore loses this option to bring out a negotiated settlement. This is what I call, somewhat paradoxically, escalatory de-escalation. The deliberate use of nuclear weapons, crossing the threshold, but for the purposes of ultimately creating a settlement. I know this sounds a little crazy, but this is actually almost exactly what a large component of NATO strategy in the Cold War, flexible response, had this option. The deliberate use of nuclear weapons had military value, but most importantly, NATO's deliberate escalation into conventional context was designed to signal resolve and impact the Soviets' will to continue the conflict. Therefore, it was escalation for the purposes ultimately of trying to de-escalate the conflict. I think those are sort of three pathways. Very briefly, I want to talk about two common arguments against no first use. The first is the impact on allies, and the second one is, would anyone believe it? I think these are also two common critiques of that. Very briefly, the concern is on the allies that no first use will weaken extended deterrence and may create incentives for them to develop their own nuclear capabilities. The reason I think that's problematic is the proposal in which I see for no first use, the allies are still covered by the U.S. nuclear umbrella. And if the no first use would still involve the threat to use nuclear weapons to deter nuclear attacks. We simply wouldn't be using them to deter conventional or biological attacks. And I can go into this. I mean, I think that conventional capabilities are adequate and far more credible in both of those circumstances. So it's not like we're totally pulling away nuclear weapons. We're still using nuclear weapons to deter nuclear attacks. I would argue that also allies really shouldn't want the U.S. to be too cavalier with nuclear weapons, since it's likely that it'll be their territory upon which the nuclear weapons are fought. The old NATO joke was, you know, that on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, the allies worried that we wouldn't use nuclear weapons, and on Tuesday, Thursday, they worried that we would. So I think that, you know, there's a potential I think that argument is relatively flawed. I would say that the United States should not adopt no first use unilaterally, and what I mean by that is it shouldn't do it without significant consultation with our allies. I think it would need a significant sustained consultation over time to walk them through this logic, to explain why retaining the option, however ambiguous, is potentially dangerous. It may take time, but there is some precedent to this, and the precedent is, in the Cold War, the change from massive retaliation to flexible response. In the 1950s, NATO strategy was predicated on the belief that the conventional defense was not possible, and therefore nuclear weapons had to be used from the outset. This was codified in MC-48 in 1954 and another NATO document, MC-14-2 in 1957. But by 1967, largely from the U.S., because the U.S. walked them through this, they switched policies. They went from a position in which they believed that a conventional defense was absolutely impossible to one in which a conventional defense was the first line of defense and nuclear weapons would only be used if a conventional defense couldn't hold. So I would argue that in what was still roughly the height of the Cold War in the 1960s, when the Soviets were building up massively, the U.S. was building up massively, we were working on MIRVs, if the United States could convince our allies to change a fundamental belief they held throughout the 1950s, I think we could I think no first use is possible. Finally, would anyone believe it? Simply declaratory policy, U.S. might not mean it. We could change it whenever is necessary. This is what people argue about China's no first use policy, although I think people who actually work on China's issues and read the documents find that there's actually some validity to those claims that they are serious about their no first use. Declaratory policy does matter. It often forms the basis of military guidance and planning, and I think it's often cited. I mean, the Prague speech and things like this get cited in military documents and planning. It shapes the public discourse, and it's a signal of public intentions. It's a signal to our adversaries. I mean, if the U.S. pores over every word of the white papers, the defense white papers from China and from Russia, it's certainly likely that others will do the same. And so I think it does matter. Finally, I think, and most importantly, a public, unequivocal declaration by the President of the United States that the United States has now adopted a policy of the no first use of nuclear weapons creates audience costs, which are the domestic and international political consequences of violating our commitments. And so essentially what audience cost is a commitment tactic. We engage our reputation for keeping our word by making it clear in public. And that increased the cost of violating our commitments. Because you can imagine that if we say we have a no first use policy and then we violate it, that may call into question the credibility of all other kinds of security, economic, and other political commitments. I mean, if the United States were willing to violate something as important as a commitment on nuclear weapons, it might be willing to change its mind on anything else. So the argument is that essentially, yes, it ultimately cannot 100% prevent an American president from using nuclear weapons, but it significantly increases the costs to them of doing so. But these policies need to be reiterated both in public and private. So it's something that you have to do over and over again, and I think you have to certainly tie these words to actions in terms of the way in which we structure our posture and our alert posture. But nevertheless, I think that there are good reasons to believe that it can be made believable. And I think I'll stop there.
Thank you, Mike.
And now on the subject of the vexed issue of extended deterrence, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I can't help myself. Mike, I thought you were going to tell the other joke, which is that the United States was committed to defending NATO to the last German.
That's also a good one.
I think Mike's talk very clearly highlighted why extended deterrence is such a popular subject of discussion these days, which is to say that extended deterrence always seems to come to the fore when the United States begins talking about a posture that approaches what might be called minimum deterrence. In fact, in the very first use of the term minimum deterrence that I can find in an official document, it's a 1961 memo by Robert McNamara that looked at three different deterrence postures for the United States, and minimum deterrence is dismissed on two grounds, one of which is we won't be able to credibly extend a commitment to protect allies. And I think that became the canonical argument against minimum deterrence, and it endured through the Cold War. To probably one of my favorite episodes, which is when in 1976, I suppose, or very late 1975, President-elect Carter was getting a briefing from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he asked, I think quite sensibly, for a study of what one could do with a 200 to 250 sized SLBM, submarine launched ballistic missile force. And the Joint Chiefs apparently immediately leaked this to Robert Novak, the late Robert Novak and Roland Evans, who modestly noted that Carter's idea would presage the end of democratic Western Europe. But, you know, it's not so strange because Carter's idea is not very far away from where we are headed now, which is to say, if you look at our operationally deployed strategic missile submarines, we've got about 290 launch tubes. And if you take 250 times a loading of four, that's 1,000 warheads. And I think those are, although I don't think the posture review is going to propose a minimum deterrence force, we are, I think, for the first time really in that neighborhood. And as a result, there's a significant amount of attention being dedicated to this issue of extended deterrence. I think so much that, and we can't say very much about it, but I think a lot of you know that there have been a series of roundtables that the Pentagon has put on. They're going to, in total, be four. And one of those for NGO experts is dedicated to the subject of extended deterrence. And it would be my judgment that extended deterrence may, in fact, be the central argument in this posture review. Now, a cynic would say extended deterrence is a wonderful argument to continue business as usual. I think that's sort of amusing. It's probably not quite fair. But there is something to that argument. And at this point, it's obligatory to say that when we talk about extended deterrence, each ally is different, just as every child is special. And within each ally, there are a range of opinions. But that's, I think, precisely why extended deterrence is such an appealing argument. Just like you can always find a lawyer who will agree with you, you can always find an ally or an aspect of an ally's government who will favor your particular policy. My favorite example of this is after Gerhard Schroeder and some of his SPD, when the Greens were the SPD's partners, made some comments about getting nuclear weapons out of Germany, and I mentioned that to a former senior U.S. official, and he said, ah, but you aren't talking to the real German government. And this I think, gives the argument a kind of stickiness. In fact, this past week I was in Winnipeg, and a Canadian academic quite seriously argued that Canada could not be confident of the United States' extended deterrent to Canada. And that Canada ought to consider a range of independent defense options, and he seemed to be toying with nuclear weapons. And I thought, look, if I can find a Canadian right, who will tell me that the extended deterrent umbrella is not credible. This is not going to be hard in other countries. Obviously, the other reason I think the argument has such appeal is, as James pointed out, it's an excellent opportunity to become a global services member. I mean, you do get to go to wonderful places. I will just say, you know that movie, Kill Bill, that restaurant where there's such a fight? It's just a wonderful restaurant. I joke about these things to give you a sense of why the argument sort of sticks, because, you know, there are, you can always find people who are going to agree with you, and it's a fascinating subject. But one of the things I notice is when we talk about extended deterrence, we don't practice very good social science, and we aren't very conscious of the observer effect, which is to say, you go and you talk to people from a foreign government, and you basically ask them for a wish list. And not surprisingly, they will give you a wish list. They will tell you all of the things that they would like to see the United States do, but that doesn't necessarily tell you what are really crucial things. And as a wayward philosophy major, I take seriously this question of method. So what I really want to focus on today are two efforts to reframe the way we look at the question of extended deterrence. First, on the subject of Japan, and then second, on the subject of NATO. It's worth noting on the subject of Japan, I think the Strategic Posture Commission report, which advocated retaining a cruise missile, which can be deployed on certain U.S. attack submarines, but which is currently in storage. The Strategic Posture Commission got a wish list from the Japanese. And I think if anybody goes and talks to the Japanese, you will get a very similar wish list. And it will start with TLAM-N, this archaic nuclear weapon that the Navy doesn't want anymore, and it will end up with precision low-yield nuclear warheads. And that's really quite serious. And what I noticed the Strategic Posture Commission did was it made a choice. It emphasized the TLAM-N as a capability to keep, but it didn't suggest, for example, developing precision low-yield nuclear warheads. And to me, that raises a fascinating methodological question, which is, how do we pick among the wish list that allies give us of the capabilities that we genuinely need to retain? And so I think the place to start answering that question is by being honest about the actual costs. And I think that in Washington, we often talk about the cost being that Japan builds nuclear weapons, but I think that is not a realistic outcome. I think there is no mainstream constituency in Japan today for building nuclear weapons. The cost to our posture decision is anxiety on the part of some Japanese officials. If we were to retire TLAM-N, some Japanese officials would feel anxious about that. Now, it's worth noting others would probably applaud the decision, particularly many of those in the new government. But I do think that there is this anxiety, and it's worth talking about why Japanese policymakers might be anxious and might fixate on certain capabilities. I would suggest, and at least this is when we really drilled down in it in our meetings in Tokyo, Japanese policymakers fundamentally don't feel like they have any alternative to the U.S. security alliance. They don't have the capacity to be sort of unarmed and neutral, and they certainly don't have the capacity to have an independent nuclear deterrent and a wildly capable military, even if they have the economic wherewithal, they don't have the political wherewithal. So at base, they have no control over their net level of security because they simply have to accept whatever the United States provides. Now, imagine being an American policymaker and being put in such a position. That would be terrifying. I think of it as kind of like a fear of flying. You become irrationally anxious when you have no control. Another colleague of mine compared it to riding on the back of a motorcycle. You can see all of the bumps and the twists and the turns, but you can't do anything about it. You're just along for the ride. And I think as a result of fundamentally not having control over one's own level of security, Japanese policymakers tend to fixate on individual capabilities as proxies or measures of the U.S. commitment to them. And in the 1990s, it was keeping 100,000 troops in East Asia, and 100,000 because it's a nice round number, not because those troops have any particular mission. Today, I think it's the nuclear-armed Tomahawk land attack missile, and tomorrow it's going to be something different. Now, what we have to do is decide which steps are in our own interest and appropriately measure the level of Japanese anxiety that produces. And it's worth noting that, you know, there are times when we decide something is in our interest, even if it causes anxiousness in Japan. And I think the Bush administration's negotiation of a six-party agreement with North Korea, which, you know, Japanese officials openly in the press would refer to as betrayal, is a very good example of where we make a strategic choice about the overall good, even if it then requires going back and doing a little bit of hand-holding. This is not to say, and I want to be really clear about this, that I'm saying we should be cavalier about Japanese security concerns. I actually think we need to be much more serious about Japanese security concerns than we have ever been in the past. But to my mind, being serious isn't retaining archaic nuclear weapons that our Navy doesn't think it can use. Being serious means putting into place the kind of robust political relationship with consultations and dialogue that would be appropriate to our most important bilateral relationship in Asia. And I will have a couple of specific policy recommendations at the end, although I think it's worth noting that I think the Obama administration, especially Kurt Campbell, are trying very hard to do that right now. I think the situation in NATO is actually rather similar. You know, the United States currently deploys a few hundred nuclear weapons at air bases in five countries in NATO. And one of the things I find interesting is NATO countries don't tend to talk about the existence of those weapons or the role that those weapons played. And in our project, we intended to be very sensitive to that. And so we had a proposal for moving the United States to 1,000 deployed warheads, and we were silent on the issue of whether any of those would be warheads deployed in Europe. But every European policymaker we talked to assumed that at 1,000 warheads, the weapons were coming home, and they were prepared to talk about offsets and other things that the United States should do, which I found very interesting. And if I think there's the dominant character, I would say, of the existence of those weapons in Europe is that we don't talk about them. I think NATO countries have been incredibly reluctant to make the public case about why they need U.S. nuclear weapons on their soil. And as a result, because there is no public case, I think you see a corresponding lack of funding for security at the sites at which the European allies provide security, and you see a corresponding lack of investment in dual-capable aircraft. And NATO's aircraft are getting quite old, and we're coming up to a series of decision points. Because there is this sense of, you know, the less said, the better, these decisions are all being deferred. And I don't think that there's much appetite in NATO to take on this thorny issue of whether they should stay or whether they should go. And as one senior NATO official told me, if it ain't broke, why fix it? But I want to suggest from an American perspective that it actually may be broken. It may be broken in an important way that may compel us to action. Which is to say, because there is no support, I worry very much about a singularity, an event. It could be a security event. Our friends from Peace Action Belgium could get in the wire with a cell phone and take a picture of a vault. It could be a very ugly public debate about certifying a particular new aircraft for nuclear weapons. You know, it could be a debate about deploying refurbished B-61s on air bases. I do worry that something could happen that will deny NATO its preferred option of not talking about this and then force the participants into a very ugly public debate, in which the result would be the rapid, disorganized, uncoordinated withdrawal of the weapons amidst recriminations. And to me, that would be much worse than beginning the dialogue about what the optimal posture is and whether that includes weapons. So let me just close with two general policy recommendations and a thought about why these two things are linked. On the issue of Japan, I confess I don't care about the Tomahawk land attack missile nuclear. If the Navy wants to retire it, let them retire it. But the goal is to focus on expanded consultation with Japan, with the ultimate goal of having consultations with the Japanese that are analogous to those that we do with our NATO partners in the NATO Nuclear Planning Group and its subsidiary high-level group. And I think the purpose of those consultations is to help communicate to the Japanese a realistic view of the role that weapons play in the United States and Japanese security, so that the Japanese view is consistent with, I think, the reduced role, not just that we want nuclear weapons play, but the reduced role that they do, as a matter of fact, play. And within NATO, I think within the context of the ongoing NATO strategic review, I think we have to examine the role of nuclear weapons within NATO security with a high, a near-term priority agenda item of immediately consolidating the existing weapons to two sites, preferably U.S. air bases where the United States provides security. The number of weapons could stay the same, but I think we do want to, as a near-term measure, consolidate in order to address security concerns and avoid this kind of singularity, while at the same time using that consolidation as a way to have a very frank dialogue about how we sustain consultation and burden sharing in a NATO context at much reduced levels of nuclear weapons, because I do think if the United States ends up around 1,000 warheads, it's very unlikely that we're going to do something like deploy 20% of them in an archaic gravity bomb system in Europe. And so instead of waiting for events to push us in, I would suggest that we be proactive. This doesn't have to be like the Baltimore Colts leaving town, for those of you who are football fans. What these two recommendations share in common, I think, is a singular focus on shifting the brunt of alliance management from hardware to software. And by software, I mean the sort of day-to-day work of alliance diplomacy. And what we should always be conscious of is never falling into the trap of allowing countries to fixate on any particular piece of hardware, because our weapons capabilities are always going to evolve and change. Our weapons and are constantly shifting, but the thing that will endure are our shared interests and our shared values.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Well, I'd like to thank both speakers, both for very, very rich presentations, but also for sticking rigidly to the timelines that I gave them in advance. There were serious deterrent threats, believe me, to keep them sticking to those timelines. The good news, of course, is that leaves us a lot of time for questions. So who wants to kick us off then? There will be a microphone circulating. I would ask everybody just to introduce themselves before asking a question. Tell us your name and where you're from. At the front here, Tom. And is there a micro? Thanks, Kim.
Tom Colina, Arms Control Association. Thank you both, all three of you, for the presentations. Very, very interesting. Excuse me. My question goes to the ongoing nuclear posture review and where you both think the issues you talked about are at play in that process, the extent that you know, and what would you predict where that will come out when the review is announced at the beginning of next year? Thanks.
Jeffrey, do you want to start on that one?
I won't steal Mike's ability to comment on declaratory posture, though he may not want to. So I'll focus on extended deterrence. I mean, I really do think that at the end of the day, as the range of plausible military missions for nuclear weapons continues to recede, in the place of those as a justification are political justifications. And you saw it in the Bush administration with Assure and Dissuade, with Assure being very directly aimed at allies and I think Dissuade actually being indirectly aimed at assuring allies. And so, you know, I think extended deterrence was a huge part of the last posture review. I think it may be the biggest part of this posture review. And that constrains how transformational one can be in terms of, or at least is thought to constrain, how transformational one can be in terms of number, declaratory posture, and type of warhead. So I would not be, for example, surprised to see the Department of Defense keeping over the objections of the Navy, the TLAM-N, which is very incongruous with the Prague speech, but it's a specific capability that some people within an important ally want to keep.
Before I ask Mike whether he has anything to say, I have to apologize because I was supposed to say at the beginning that Mike's comments here purely reflect his own personal opinion and are not in any way associated with any of the organizations that he does work for. I apologize for not saying that in advance.
I was going to say it. Jeffrey, did you want to make any comments on declaratory policy?
No.
It's a difficult question. Declaratory policy has always been a very contentious issue in large part because it's about deterrence and it's a battle of logics. We can't prove that I can't plot it on a graph and say clearly it's going in this direction. We can look at things like weapon systems and say, well, these are aging here, this is doing that, this, and we can sort of get our hands around it analytically, but ultimately questions about declaratory policy are ultimately questions about deterrence and questions that turn on sort of battles of whose deductive logic is more persuasive. So the answer is I really don't know. I think that the Prague speech set the bar quite high and raised expectations perhaps in the international community as well as I think the nonproliferation and nuclear community, our community, that there were going to be some pretty fundamental changes in declaratory policy. Could be one obvious place where that could happen. But there's also strong arguments. Again, as Jeffrey pointed out, if extended deterrence is going to be the key issue in this nuclear policy review, it's also one of the key arguments against no first use. Ultimately, the answer is I don't know where it's going to come out. I think I'll just leave it at that.
Thanks, Mike. Stephen, yeah.
Stephen Young with the Union Concerned Scientists. Question for Mike on no first use and the statements by some that that position wouldn't be credible by the U.S., wouldn't be credible for the U.S. diplomatic policy. But couldn't you make it credible by changing also your deployment policies, change how you field your submarines, change how you deploy your ICBMs, take the requirement of being on alert away, so not required to be on alert any longer, basically go toward a Chinese posture, which in my view makes that policy relatively credible. Wouldn't that help answer that question?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that the words have to be followed by deeds. But I think you need both. I don't think you can do just one without the other. So I think declaratory policy is a good starting place. But ultimately, yes, actions have to follow those words, and deployment patterns and alert status is one way to go about that. So absolutely, I think they're absolutely hand in hand.
Yes. Sorry, I don't know your name.
Hi, I'm David Stern from the Simpson Center. I guess this question is mostly for Jeffrey. There were rumblings in Europe and NATO following the United States' decision to switch from the planned Site 3 ground-based interceptor missile defense to SM-3s, and that decision, a lot of people criticized it, thought it had it reflected a poor U.S. security commitment to our allies. How do you think that would impact our potential policy options in regards to extended deterrence with our allies and still trying to balance that with, you know, guaranteed nuclear security umbrella and making sure that those alliances stay intact?
I suppose my first answer to that was this was something about the debate that I fundamentally did not understand. I mean, it seemed crazy to me. It's you're deploying a more capable system faster that covers, you know, more of the allies. I would have thought that this would be a big win, but it does get at this thing, and we noticed this in our own consultations, which is to say that allies don't always make, particularly people at the foreign ministry level who are very concerned about how things feel and how they look, they don't sit down and do technical calculations about the precise natures of the architectures. And so you get, I think, in many cases, an unhealthy fixation on specific capabilities that bear little or no relationship to the alliance, or, you know, the credibility of the alliance threats, or even the capability of the alliance. And I will digress with one example of that. I was recently in South Korea, and I kept talking about reducing the number of nuclear weapons. And one reason, by the way, to do that is you might free up, say, B-52s, some of which are currently training for nuclear missions, to go off and actually be useful, like, you know, dropping bombs on Taliban. And the South Koreans kept saying, you know, why do you want to reduce U.S. nuclear capabilities? And it's like, no, I said the number, the capabilities may stay flat. In fact, in some cases, the overall combat capability may go up. But there is this tendency to substitute fixations on specific things for broader judgments about alliance credibility. And I think that it is incumbent on any administration of any political stripe to avoid ever falling into that trap. Because whether you like the particular thing they are fixated on at this particular moment, you will end up tying your hands. I think General Fogelman once said, tying your hands as you go down the road, to mix a metaphor, which I love. You'll end up tying your hands as you go down the road, and you will regret it.
Thank you. Yes, at the very back.
Walt Slocum. I'm a lawyer. I used to work in the Defense Department.
Jordan used to play some ball.
I wanted to ask about the force structure implications of a no first use policy, because it seems to me it is not self-evident that it reduces the force structure requirement. For example, in contrast to what Dr. Young said, it seems to me it makes survivability and alert rates much more important, because by hypothesis you have to be able to absorb a first strike. What does it also mean for command and control survivability, which is the biggest vulnerability in any system that depends on a post-strike decision? And what does it mean for conventional forces? By hypothesis, you were going to be relying on conventional forces for things that, at least in principle, you might do with nuclear weapons. I don't think you can do with nuclear weapons, but you can pretend you can. And then finally, what is your thought as to what it means for targeting policy? Because it's always seemed to me one of the difficulties about relying on nuclear weapons to respond to chemical and biological weapons is what the appropriate targets are. But it's also true that one of the reasons for the launch under attack or for preemption is a belief that you have to have a very high level of damage expectancy in order to achieve deterrence, at least against first-class opposition.
The simple, straightforward question for you to engage with there, Mike.
Thank you. I'll try a couple of those. I don't think that the force restructure requirements necessarily have to change. There needs to be some mechanism by which one equates words to actions. I would say on the issue of that it may, in fact, increase the necessity to keep forces on alert, that only really matters for Russia. And a lot of the logic, a lot of the argument that I'm playing out, I mean, Russia is certainly one player here, but that also, I mean, the extent to which the United States has a first strike capability against Russia is questionable. And so those dynamics are not quite as robust or not quite as acute, because the concern that I'm laying out is when an adversary fears of a U.S. disarming first strike, which is really countries that have very minimal nuclear forces. So I take your point on it not necessarily change force structure requirements, but it in the case of U.S. survivability, U.S. alert rates, that really only matters for one country that may or may not have the capability to launch a first strike of its own. On the conventional forces, what does that do to conventional forces? I think it puts an added premium on the United States ensuring that it maintains conventional superiority no matter what. A posture that has no first use in it essentially guards against the military from ever thinking, I don't think they would ever think this, but from ever thinking that nuclear weapons provide a cheap alternative or some sort of a force multiplier in conventional contingencies, or that, for that matter, chemical and biological contingencies. So in that sense, a no first use posture necessitates a very strong conventional force. Now, I admit that seems to me that one reason that adversaries are very concerned about the United States and very concerned and perhaps interested in developing their own nuclear capabilities is because of our conventional superiority. So there is a balance to be struck between maintaining conventional dominance and scaring others into developing nuclear weapons as a means to offset our conventional superiority. On targeting policy, what do we respond to? If we were going to use nuclear weapons to respond to chem-bio, what would we hit? And what would we hit that we couldn't hit with nuclear weapons? And might not nuclear weapons only complicate the battle space? I'm sorry, conventional. Yes, thank you. I have a feeling you're going to be correcting me on many points on this at some point. I think it's exactly right that the targeting is always an issue. I mean, I tend to take the view, just as a separate note, that second strike counterforce is a very good way to go. If an adversary crosses the nuclear threshold and shows both the capability and the will to do so, a good policy may be to then go after everything that's left. I do think that one of the big problems with chem-bio is, what would we hit and what would we hit that we couldn't hit with conventional, and might not using nuclear weapons only complicate the battle space, create fire, fallout, fire, panic in other cities as their fear that they may be next, and ultimately complicate prosecuting the war and winning the peace.
Thank you. Yes. Just yeah. Amy, yep.
Jan Ho Kim with Voice of America. I'd like to ask about...
Amy who I was... Amy Wolf.
Now I'm confused. Amy Wolf, Congressional Research Service, and I don't mean to pile on, but I'm going to pile on Michael a little bit. You just confused me, and when you were going through your three examples of why maintaining a first-use policy is dangerous, you talked about a country dispersing its nuclear weapons, loading up its TELs, you know, having a risk of accidental or unauthorized launch. Who else besides Russia would be in that kind of position? I mean, nobody else that we might be shooting at except Russia or maybe China, and China's already built to ride it out, would be in that position. So I assumed you were talking about Russia because that's what it sounded like to me. So if there's someone else who I'm missing that we might be inspiring to have their own preemptive first-use attack against us, I'm wondering who it is. And second, you talked about withdrawing from a first-use posture because it's not credible to threaten nuclear use against chemical and biological weapons, but your dangers were against a nuclear-armed state. So is it, I agree we shouldn't be willy-nilly threatening nuclear use against chemical and biological nations, but there was a disconnect there that you're withdrawing for one reason. You're pulling back the role of nuclear weapons, but you're leaving it with nuclear, but then your risks are nuclear. And then I have one final comment, not to be pedantic, but you claim that if we made a no first use pledge, the politics of having made the pledge will be restricting to us because if we then use nuclear weapons, we'd look bad because we violated the pledge. I'd like to argue that whether or not we make the pledge, we'd look bad because we use nuclear weapons. And the added looking bad, probably not much of a deterrent from crossing the threshold.
I was only, in the context of Russia, I was only talking about Russia. Mr. Slocum's comment was Russia's targeting our command and control, essentially Russia launching, if I understood him correctly, a splendid first strike attempt on us. So in that context, they're the only ones that can do that. But in the scenarios that I laid out, there may be cases in which an adversary sees advantage in using nuclear weapons against us. That's not an attempt at a disarming first strike. Any of the countries, I mean, with the exception of our allies, countries that have nuclear weapons. I mean, what's the... Well, certainly Russia and China are two. The extent to which others are developing mobile capabilities increases. I mean, we were talking down the line, but the extent to which there is a trend towards mobile and relocatable forces. So I'm only talking about in the context of a disarming first strike against the United States, against Russia, but others may in fact see the need to maintain survivability for the use to strike against the United States, but not in the context of a disarming first strike, in the context of de-escalating a conflict, or in the context of seeing that they either have – it's either now or never, and somehow this is better than averting an even worse situation. I agree completely that we would look bad if we used nuclear weapons. I think the pledge is an added element there, but the United States has always retained this option. We always have this sort of all-on-the-table approach. Certainly using nuclear weapons would violate the taboo, would break a seven-plus decade, or almost seven-decade record of nuclear non-use. But in the context of we're narrowing our commitments even further, adding to that pledge is just one more step in that process. But I take your point completely.
Okay. Yes, Leonor.
Sorry, just hold on 1 second for the microphone.
Leonor Tamiro, Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. And my question is for Jeffrey about the B-61s in Europe. What's the military value of B-61s and how do the allies who are in favor of keeping them, what do they think the military value is? And do you lose anything in terms of deterrence by eliminating them that you don't already get with our ballistic missiles? Thank you.
Without Without describing who said this, I feel very confident in saying that at the highest levels in NATO, it is understood that the United States would never use a B-61 off the wing of an airplane in any conceivable scenario that would involve NATO. And I'm those same people will, you know, deny that in public, but I don't think there is any military utility to those weapons. It doesn't mean that there aren't scenarios in which nuclear weapons might be useful. I just don't think we would use those, and I don't think we would give them to the Dutch to use. So, and to me, this is the crux of the problem, which is, you know, you have nuclear weapons sitting in Turkey. The last time there was a surety inspection, there was no aircraft generation exercise, which leads me to conclude that there are some issues associated with whether there are aircraft. And so why can't you I'll say it this way. Isn't it dangerous to have weapons sitting around that you can't use and that you don't want because you're not willing to make the effort to consult and explain the purpose of those weapons? And I've heard very senior policymakers and very senior military officials say that they feel they would be comfortable if the weapons came out of Turkey if you let them then let the Turks participate in exercises where they could see the actual capabilities that we would use to defend them. And if you did give them the option to participate in plausible defense missions with the goal of basically preserving consultation and burden sharing, I would say. It's those two things you preserve. And the weapons are in some sense valuable because, you know, the Europeans have to pay for security for them, and so at some level they're committed to the mission. But I think, as I discussed earlier, they aren't really doing that. So I'd rather encourage them to pay for something that they think they can use and that bears some plausible relationship to the military role of the alliance.
Thank you. Gentleman just at the front here.
Thank you very much. Brian Bender with the Boston Globe. Maybe both of you can take a stab at this. Michael, you sort of touched on this in your opening remarks about military options. Obviously, the Nuclear Posture Review will have a significant element which will look at just that. I'm wondering if you both could give your analysis or opinion on how much that desire for military options could hamstring some of these other, I guess, political desires to de-emphasize nuclear weapons or the uses of nuclear weapons.
Who wants to start with that one? Jeffrey?
Sure. Well, I mean, I mean, in a strange way, I don't think that should complicate extended deterrence because, I mean, the way I envision the problem that we have with extended deterrence now is it's not about, yes, I understand abstractly that a desire to hold in reserve a variety of contingencies against a variety of options leads you to have forces for implausible options that you may not necessarily need. But at least as I see it, I mean, we have a worse problem with our allies right now, which is we have not done the hard work of even explaining to them that forces we want to get rid of, that even we don't want to hold the option for anymore, are no longer necessary to their security. So in some sense, because these things have become a proxy more so than they've become an option, I think that's why they stay around. But, I mean, I can certainly see in, because I also do the stuff that Mike does, I mean, I'm certainly aware at how trying to guard against the least likely probabilities presses you into retaining capabilities are, I think I said earlier, incongruous, to say the least, with the kinds of things that the president is trying to do diplomatically.
Mike, anything you want to add?
This desire for more and more options has essentially been the story of the development of U.S. nuclear strategy through the Cold War, beginning with flexible response and on to NISDM 242 and limited nuclear options, and then PD-59, the countervailing strategy. I mean, it was essentially all about more and more options to provide a credible deterrent across the spectrum of conflict, to ensure that the Soviets believed that there was no option for which the United States did not have an appropriate and credible response. And so this idea of more and more options is deeply ingrained in the thinking of nuclear strategy and nuclear declaratory policy. And so it is a significant obstacle because of the point that, well, why? If you start playing the what-if game, it's, well, what if this, what if that? Well, we should just not have any other option. We should have every option possible.
Thanks. I am trying to take these questions more or less in the order I see them. Bruce McDonald. Sorry, Kim, just at the front here.
Bruce McDonald with the Strategic Posture Review Commission. A question, I think, primarily for Jeffrey. I take it from your comments that you're not questioning the value of extended deterrence, but although correct me if I'm wrong on that, but you do have some concerns about the way that it's being implemented, let's say. And I, in looking and or thinking about what you said, I also did a quick review. I mean, not only the Posture Commission came out in support of the extended deterrence and maintaining assurances, and in particular on the TLAM-N, as you mentioned. But the Council on Foreign Relations panel also spoke out very strongly in favor of maintaining nuclear weapons in Europe as long as the NATO allies felt it was politically reassuring. So I guess my question is, one, do I understand you correctly about extended deterrence in general? And then specifically, I sense in your comments a bit of a sense, well, here's the way our allies ought to feel. I mean, Japan shouldn't just need a TLAM-N. And we certainly don't want to just sit back and, like, take an order. Well, they'll have, you know, a TLAM-N with a side of fries, you know, and just, you know, respond to it. But on the other hand, we can't be ignorant either of what it is that reassures them. If we have a friend who has a particular issue, we may think, well, they shouldn't feel that way. But the reality is they do feel that way. And it strikes me as the best way is to deal with where they're coming from and not to say, well, you shouldn't feel that way, so therefore we're going to change things. So maybe you can clarify your intention a little bit on that question. How do you deal with anxieties or concerns, security concerns of allies, even if maybe in our calm, rational moments we say to ourselves, well, they shouldn't feel that way?
Well, let me start by saying, if it wasn't clear, I intended to compliment the Posture Commission, although I disagree with the TLAM-N recommendation, because I am certain that, you know, you, as everybody else who has ever done this, must have been confronted with the wish list, and the wish list ran from I suspect the things that you recommended to things that you did not, and so that raises the natural question, as you say. How do you not just take an order, but on the other hand, not blow them off? What rule set do you use to make wise decisions about what is in both of our interests without just sort of mechanically reproducing, you know, what you're told? And I was trying to make explicit in some way that rule set. So the way that I approached that was I tried to talk about – it's not that I think how they ought to feel, but I tried to emphasize what I think – is happening, which is to say, yes, you get a wish list, but I suspect, and I don't think this is something that is negative about the Japanese, because I imagine as an American policymaker, you know, you would feel exactly the same way. I suspect it's incredibly anxiety-inducing to not have fundamental control over your level of security, and that's a real problem. I think it's a relatively healthy thing in this sense that the Japanese fixations have been as relatively limited as they have, because this would be terror-inducing. And so my suggestion is we can, instead of playing this game of giving allies exactly what they ask for in terms of specific capabilities, that we address this at the root cause, which is by dramatically expanding the type of consultation we have. And I realize that that's not easily done, and I know that the State Department is working, is moving heaven and earth to increase the quality of our discussions with the Japanese. But I think that our goal with the Japanese should not be short-term hardware solutions, but needs to be a long-term effort to build the same kinds of consultations that we have with the members of the NATO Nuclear Planning Group. And within that context, if you have that kind of consultation, then I think that allows you to do what's right, to do what's in your interest, to maximize your capabilities, and then use the consultation process so that the allies understand that. Because I think it's crazy, and it's a sign of how of what a poor job we have done that the Japanese government seems to be emphasizing, at least privately, a capability that the Navy thinks is useless. I mean, that's quite a stunning gap. between the warfighters and the political decision makers. And I, you know, more so than retaining the capability, I would emphasize closing that gap.
I wonder if I could just abuse my chairman's prerogative by adding something onto that answer, which is, if the issue is fundamentally that U.S. allies doubt U.S. resolve, deploying a particular capability is going to do nothing to reduce their anxiety. I mean, one reading of the history of the Cold War in Europe is that the U.S. kept on giving new and better capabilities to Europe, but European policymakers didn't worry less about the U.S. commitment. Their worry was pretty much constant. And I would actually expect exactly the same thing to happen with Japan. I mean, if the Navy was not to mothball TLAM-N and indeed to go further and redeploy it, I actually think that Japan, the Japanese government, would come back privately saying, well, this is the next capability you need. And the only way to actually get equilibrium on that is precisely the kind of software upgrades that Jeffrey is talking about.
But, may I just say on that, too?
Absolutely.
Publication of a number of the expert papers that were written in support of the commission, I think at least one or two of which will touch a little bit more on these very issues. So informed.
Thanks. I think it's generally a bad idea to allow two fingers in a gathering this big, but since it's Walt Slocum at the back, then I'm going to allow a one-off two fingers.
Thank you. You haven't mentioned, and it's connected with this, an argument which was always made in favor of the dual-capable aircraft, and I suppose can be made about TLAM-N, that they were seen as uniquely connected with extended deterrence, and in particular that U.S. nuclear weapons in Europe meant there was... I mean, I never believed this argument, but it was widely made. And I wondered what your view on it, that it's not entirely a sort of cargo cult fixation on the part of the Allies. It is to some degree been rationalized as these are uniquely for extended deterrence, and if you get rid of them, we're just a sort of lesser included case in the general deterrent. I don't believe that argument, but I'd be interested if you did.
You want to deal with this in two sentences?
I agree it's not just a cargo cult fixation. And I can understand how it would be unpleasant to be a lesser included case, but I think that that is the fact of the matter. It's not a bad thing, and we can talk our way out of this by holding hands.
Thank you. There was a question towards the front on this side, which now seems to have disappeared. Gentlemen just at the front here.
Hi, Gary Mitchell from the Mitchell Report. I want to pose a question that may be just a clumsier way of posing one that's already been asked. I'm not quite sure, but it sort of has two components to it, and that is, given the political, global political realities of 2009, what's the practical operating distinction between no first use and no use? And second, given that what we seem to be more concerned about these days is non-state actors with nukes, what's the value of the sort of game theory way of thinking about this approach?
Trying to understand a little bit the difference between no first use and no use. Do you mean a no use policy or just not using nuclear weapons, just the fact that we haven't used them?
If we're talking about U.S. policy,
Understood. Okay. I'd make a couple of points. I mean, I think that if we're not apt to use them anyway, then we get a lot of political benefit from the non-nuclear NPT member states from declaring no first use. So if we're not going to do it anyway, then we might as well take out any risk of any potential for crisis instability and get the political benefit of being seen to move closer to fulfilling our Article 6 commitments, getting the non-nuclear NPT member states on board, at least so they, more so on non-proliferation objectives. So that's the sort of way I would look at that, is that there's benefit to doing if we're not if your point is we're not going to use it anyway, then we might as well get the political benefits of making that clear.
I also want to say that I think of the we. I think there was a question earlier that was sort of in this same arena, which is when we talk about who are the nuclear states and what is the likelihood that any of them are going to use nukes against anyone. That's the we I'm really talking about, not just us, but that state actors versus non-state actors are highly unlikely to be deploying nukes, despite the fact that they're putting billions of dollars.
That's exactly right, which is why I said that in the unlikely event that nuclear weapons are used, it is likely to be in the context of an intense and severe crisis. And therefore, one way to look at this issue is through the lens of crisis stability. So by the nature of the logic of the argument, it sort of postulates a very intense crisis, which is not likely to happen, but not zero. And the concerns about preemption are what can exacerbate an already dangerous situation. And so, yes, absolutely. I'm not saying that this is likely, but my argument is in the unlikely event that nuclear weapons are used, it's going to be in this context, and therefore this is one way to look at those dynamics. On the distinction between state and non-state actors, I don't really see how nuclear weapons are particularly relevant either to deterring non-state actors or to responding to their use, in large part because, as everyone knows, there's the return address problem. So it doesn't seem that nuclear weapons would be particularly relevant there. And in some situations, a nuclear response may in fact be beneficial for these organizations to rally support around them, to be seen as the U.S. bearing down on them again. So not only I don't think it's particularly relevant, I don't think it's particularly likely, but the use of nuclear weapons in response, particularly against some country in which these states in which these actors were harbored, does not seem to be a useful mechanism for deterrence or for response.
Jessica Matthews at the very back, and I should say if there are people at the back kind of three or four rows trying to attract my attention, it's very, very hard to see you, so do wave your hand high.
Thanks, Jim. I want to follow up on, and perhaps there's nothing more to say than the exchange on this last question, but most of this discussion felt very Cold War-ish to me. In the sense of, in that period, the people who thought about vertical proliferation and the people who thought about horizontal proliferation operated in totally separate universes. And a consequence of the end of the Cold War was they finally began to intersect. But most of this discussion had a priesthood quality that sounded, again, divorced from the threats that we actually faced. And maybe Michael said what there is to say on his side, and I think your last answer did begin to take us towards that. But if you rethink these issues, or let's say this, if you fold in not a negative consequence of let's avoid doing something that is incongruous with what stated policy now is on proliferation, but if you fold it in as a positive criterion of what you want your policy to be, how does that affect, I think, both these issues, and maybe Jeff wants to speak to it on extended deterrence. I mean, we do have with the 13 points, for example, a rather explicit agenda of things that the nuclear weapon states have committed to that seldom tends to show up as we do this kind of thinking.
I wonder if I could say a few words to start with in answer to that question, because the reason I invited Mike in particular to speak about no first use
was because the non-proliferation benefits of no first use are heard a lot in this town at the moment. I mean, many of you will have read Scott Sagan's article in Survival, in which he was very, very clearly arguing this from a non-proliferation perspective, which I think is a very important component of the debate, but one that's heard a lot here in Washington. What I was really interested in doing was bringing this in from a military perspective as well. And the reason is, I guess, although it does sound quite Cold War-ish, there are particular examples that I foresee in my mind in which a policy of calculated ambiguity can potentially be destabilizing. I mean, in terms of examples, let's imagine a North Korea 5 or 10 years down the line, which has started to bury its missiles in silos. Ash Carter and Bill Perry, as many people remember, wrote an op-ed a few years ago arguing for a first strike with conventional weapons on North Korea's launch pad. 5 or 10 years from now, if the North Korea process has gone badly and North Korea is starting to bury weapons in silos, you could imagine the US starting to talk about a nuclear first strike on North Korea. I don't think that's likely, but if it were to happen, then the kind of crisis instability that Mike is talking about could lead North Korea to preempt. I think the same thing is true if everything goes wrong with Iran 5 or 10 years down the line. So just to kind of put forward what my thinking on this event was and why I think we should worry about these things, both through the non-proliferation lens and through kind of like the Cold War crisis stability lenses, is because there are unlikely scenarios that I can construct. But if they were to pass, the consequences of maintaining calculated ambiguity, in my mind, still could be very serious. So that was my particular interest in kind of framing this around today. But let me just see if Mike and Jeffrey have anything else they want to add.
I do. I mean, I adore that framing. I ended by saying that our capabilities will change. It's our shared interests and values that will endure. And as I was planning out this talk, I was a little worried about that sentence because that's not exactly what I mean, because it's the interests themselves may evolve. It's the indivisibility of our security and the fact that we share our interests that will not change, and it's our values that will not change. And so one of the reasons that I think it is so important to build better consultation mechanisms and get away from this fixation on hardware is that the hardware itself is intended, by definition, to deal with the threats of the past. And so to the extent that politically we fixate on hardware that is designed to deal with past threats, I think that we inhibit ourselves from thinking creatively about how our interests have changed and how going forward we are going to want our alliances to function. So from my perspective, the entire reason for doing this is not just clearing away dead wood, but it is really empowering policymakers in all of the countries involved to do something better and more appropriate for the future.
I would just say it does. My argument does harken back certainly to some Cold War arguments, and I would just say, I mean, it should be clear by looking at me, I didn't live through most of the Cold War, but I'm somebody who believes that some of those arguments, not everything, but some of it is still relevant, and that while it's a mistake to assume that it's all the same, it's equally a mistake to assume that everything is different, and this is just sort of one lens through which I think one can view these issues. I think we worried a lot about crisis stability in the Cold War, and perhaps even too much. Once both sides had survivable second strike systems deployed across land, sea, and air platforms, a lot of this there were still arguments to be made, particularly with deployment of some specific systems. But nevertheless, I think that the crisis and stability threat have been mitigated. Today, the situation may be different when the United States has lots of offense, potentially offensive counterforce first strike capabilities against an adversary with limited survivability, limited weapons.
I'd be very partial in going to this side. Gentleman in the aisle seat, about two-thirds of the way back.
Yes.
I'm Dr. Will Curtis from the U.S. Naval Academy. And following on what Amy had suggested, and you sparked this question in my mind, so if there's anything wrong with it, you assume the responsibility. Okay. One is that if indeed we have a lack of a public discussion in Europe regarding what I call non-strategic nuclear weapons or tactical nuclear weapons that are part of the extended deterrence that we guarantee to NATO, then I would just suggest that it's a lack of the ability on the part of decision makers to explain the nature of the threat. If you understand what I'm saying, why are we extending deterrence to Europe, and whom would the adversary be? Who has the capability to threaten? And if you say it's the former Soviet Union and the former Warsaw Pact, well, Russia at this point, then you may have difficulties there in explaining it. Secondly, is that this issue of extending deterrence, if I could, you're talking about looking 5 years down in the future, Iran and so forth. What if Iran does develop a nuclear capability and it sparks either a request on the part of the Saudis or the Egyptians or the Gulf State people for the U.S. to extend that umbrella of protection to them? What are the prospects for that?
Well, to tackle the second question first, regardless of how and why we choose to extend deterrence to the Middle East, I think it is extremely unlikely that we would ever forward deploy nuclear weapons there, which I think reflects back on the situation in Europe, because I think if the weapons weren't there, we wouldn't be talking about putting them there today, nor do I think we would be talking about deploying TLAM-N. It's only because they are already there. So I agree that policymakers have some trouble communicating the value of extended deterrence, particularly in Japan and in some parts of, at least within most of those parts of NATO where we have forward deployed nuclear weapons. But the solution that we have talked about to date, right, which is to not talk about those capabilities or retain archaic capabilities, I don't think solves that problem. I mean, I think what we need to do is to find things that we can talk about, interests that we do share, and things that going forward we do want to do. And there are some political sensitivities in how you phrase that. But I do think that one of the great benefits of talking, for example, in NATO about what role nuclear weapons play is shifting the focus away from very classic Cold War-style deterrence missions to what I think is a much broader interest in nonproliferation.
Thank you. Greg Tillman and then Charlie Glazer.
Greg Tillman, Arms Control Association. Most of our discussion has been about crisis stability or the sensibilities of allies. But there is a bear in the room that we haven't really spent much time talking about, and that is the strategic negotiating partner, the U.S., the Russian Federation. Could I get a little bit of a flavor for your thoughts on how Russia would react to some of the changes you're advocating, the U.S. Adopting no first use or getting rid of its tactical nuclear weapons in Europe? One can argue, I think, in two different directions about Russian reaction, but I'm very curious about your thoughts.
Mike, do you want to go first?
I think that the United States adopting policy of the no first use of nuclear weapons can be potentially a useful mechanism to put pressure on the other members, with the exception of China, who already has a no-first-use policy, to adopt similar policies. Now, Russia is in the START negotiations and the outcome of that, which we know what the parameters are, but we don't know the specifics, and we don't know what the future. We don't know what the follow-on is going to look like if we're in fact going to negotiate on non-strategic nuclear forces. But I think that, in terms of, one of the things I haven't talked about is what are the benefits of no first use, and I think one of the benefits is to increase pressure on others to adopt similar policies, to follow a model that China would obviously and has asked the United States and the other P5 to do, and that's the context in which I see one of the benefits is potentially putting additional pressure on Russia who of course had a no first use and then reversed it. And of course part of the reason they reversed it is because of the conventional weaknesses and necessity to essentially pull the NATO model, which is rely increasingly on their nuclear forces. However, it seems like part of the reason that the range of strategic nuclear delivery vehicles is as wide as it is because their nuclear systems are also aging out. And so lower numbers benefit them at that sense as well. So I don't want to stay specific, too specific on that issue, but I think it is a useful mechanism to put pressure on Russia. But I think that there's a lot of variables, in particular the outcome of the strategic nuclear delivery vehicle issue in the START follow-on and what the START and what the follow-on to the follow-on looks like.
Well, let me start by saying I did recommend consolidation to two sites and that we have a conversation about how we maintain burden sharing and consultation at lower numbers. And lower numbers could include zero, but, you know, I don't necessarily feel strongly about that outcome. I mean, you could stop at consolidation. You could go to some kind of rear deployment where the weapons are in the U.S. and the Europeans have capacities to stage in the U.S. You could do, you know, Trident SSBN visits. I'm open to life's possibilities as a result of that conversation. But I guess to really answer the question about Russia, I will observe that there are people who argue that those few remaining forward deployed nuclear weapons provide some measure of leverage with the Russians in terms of engaging them. And I have to say I'm very skeptical of that. I mean, given the numerical disparity, it's not clear to me that, you know, 200 versus many thousands that are actually in some way linked to the defense concept of the Russian Federation. I don't think there's much leverage there. There are some people who think that at zero, you may paradoxically have slightly more leverage than at a trivial number. I don't know. But it seems to me that however that plays out, the amount of leverage, if any, is so small and the potential gain is so small that it's probably not a reason to keep them around. I mean, I continue to think that the reason to get rid of them is because we do run this persistent year after year risk of some kind of event that does much more damage to alliance cohesion, whether it's a security incident or some ugly public debate, and that we would be much better off putting the relationship on footing that emphasizes, you know, I mean, it's the footing that emphasizes the cemeteries at Normandy more than it does, you know, some weapons in a bunker that nobody sees.
Charlie Glazer.
The Elliott School at GW. I have two questions, I think, for Michael. One is, you said, well, if we accept that the nuclear weapons are for deterrence, then these various things follow. But there is another set of arguments out there, which is you might want to use nuclear weapons first to protect yourself against nuclear weapons. So you might want to use them to destroy an Iranian capability if it ever had one. James referred to the possibility of a future North Korean one, and a Chinese capability is vulnerable. So it seems like you've made your argument too easy, in a sense, by not taking that set of possible uses into consideration. I'm not saying that I've necessarily come to a different conclusion, but that might be the most important set of first uses out there. And then the second thing is, it seems in your talk to me that you sometimes conflated first use with first strike, and I wanted to make sure which one you're actually referring to, because NATO doctrine, as you know, was first use, but it wasn't necessarily a large-scale counter-military strike. And so there could be limited uses that would be purposeful against moderate, you know, medium-sized or even large adversaries that are not large-scale counter-military uses, and some of which would be different than the logic that you laid out. So I just wanted to see if you could address those.
Feels like we're back in class. That's a former professor of mine. If I understood you correctly, what you're talking about is the decision for the U.S. to preempt with nuclear weapons. Is that correct? Okay. Yeah. That is. This is the product of this whole thing is the product of something I've been working on off and on for a year, and it's, as many of you have painfully pointed out to me, it's not quite done, So again, I'm still sort of working through this, but essentially, I laid out three options by which the United States may threaten to use and or use nuclear weapons first. The first is to deter conventional. The second is to deter chemical and biological. And the third is to preempt. So I didn't include that here, but I absolutely agree. I mean, I would make a couple points, which I think you'd agree with, because some of this came from some of your work, that is true that the United States may, in fact, want to use nuclear weapons to preempt the use of nuclear weapons. But there are lots of problems with that. Most importantly, couldn't the United States ever be absolutely confident that it would achieve such a disarming first strike? And I take your point. I'll get to that in a second. But, yeah, first strike is in a splendid first strike. Could the United States ever be confident that it, in fact, got everything? And if some weapons survived, some we didn't know about, were used in retaliation, might that retaliation outweigh the potential costs of the strike in the first place? The United States could never be probably absolutely confident it knew where every nuclear weapon was, nor might it not necessarily actually be completely confident that, in fact, the adversary was actually intending to strike rather than just signaling for purposes of resolve and survivability, in which case the United States, in preempting, had essentially started the nuclear war that it had hoped to prevent. Another issue there is the move towards mobility and mobile and relocatable targets. The example here is the United States doesn't have a very good track record on doing these kinds of things, locating and targeting mobile and relocatable targets. As an example, the great Scud hunt of the first Gulf War didn't go so well. According to the Gulf War Air Power Survey, the United States launched approximately, as I recall, 1,500 sorties against Iraqi mobile and fixed Scud launchers, and the Gulf War Air Power Survey said there's not a single confirmed kill of a mobile Scud launcher. Similar problems in Operation Allied Force in 1999 when the United States attempted to the Serbs attempted to move their SA-6 surface-to-air missile batteries essentially every couple of hours to prevent them from being struck. And according to some NATO estimates, I don't think there's an official estimate that attempts to strike those SA-6 SAM batteries, we got 3 of the known 25. As the move towards mobility is in part a mechanism to increase survivability, and it significantly complicates whether or not the United States can actually launch a successful first strike. There may be some scenarios in which it's the case. I mean, I don't but again, I think that no first use makes it so that it's prohibitively difficult. And I also, and again, to this gentleman's point, I mean, to the extent to which the United States would ever launch such a splendid first strike, if we're not going to do it, we might as well get some benefit from some political benefit from it. I take your point exactly on first strike and first use. I may have mixed the two. I what I'm talking about is a potential for a U.S. first strike, a U.S. disarming first strike. The fear of that and the crisis stability dynamic may lead to first use on the other side. In a couple of cases, there's a potential first strike incentive if they can disarm us. But in most cases, what I'm talking about is the limited first use, in large part for the de-escalatory purposes that NATO strategy had as part of its doctrine.
Thank you. Any remaining questions? There was at least one person. I see one there. I just want to find out whether anybody else wants to. There was one question over here, which I know I hadn't been taking for a while. But okay, so final question for the afternoon. Yes, sir. And the microphone's just coming.
Yes, Hugh Haskell from the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. We've heard lots of talk, not just here but everywhere, about the purpose of our nuclear weapons being deterrence. And the word deterrence is used kind of axiomatically. It seems to me that the main deterrent effect of our nuclear missile, or our nuclear arsenal, has been to cause other people to develop nuclear arsenals to deter us. And I wonder if maybe we could discuss if deterrence, assuming for the moment that deterrence is a valid reason for having nuclear weapons, just exactly who our nuclear arsenal is supposed to deter.
Either of you want to take that?
I'll make it just a couple. Finish up. I mean, I would. There may be some situations in which nuclear proliferation is intended to deter our nuclear weapons. I think in most cases, while there are many reasons why states develop nuclear weapons, prestige and domestic politics and other things, one of the most important reasons vis-a-vis the United States is to deter our conventional capability rather than our nuclear capability. In this context, nuclear proliferation is in some ways an asymmetric response to U.S. conventional superiority. Because I'm fond of history, as it's very clear to you, I mean, the irony here is that this is essentially NATO strategy, where we relied on the threat of nuclear escalation to deter a conventionally superior adversary. So I would just make that point about whether or not nuclear weapons are primarily a response to our nuclear weapons or whether or not they're a response to other things. Let's see. I think I'll let Jeffrey take it.
I guess I would simply say that regardless of whether we agree or disagree about the impact that U.S. nuclear weapons and security assurances have had in terms of increasing or decreasing proliferation, I think we can all agree that looking forward, discouraging the further spread, as Ernie Cantor always reminds me, discouraging the further spread of nuclear weapons is something that is a much more significant interest now than it has been in the past. And, you know, again, you know, I think the ability to make our alliances, both in terms of their political content, but also their military capabilities, responsive to new challenges, and that includes the president's Prague agenda, requires putting in place better consultative mechanisms so we can get away from the fixations on hardware that was designed to deal with yesterday's threat.
Thank you. I think all that remains for me to do is to thank you all for coming and then thank the speakers. The president set out an exceptionally ambitious agenda in his Prague address. And it seemed to me, looking at that, that these were two of the absolute thorniest issues that needed to be addressed, that of the circumstances in which the U.S. Holds open the option to use nuclear weapons first, and that of how it deals with its allies. And my sense was that these were issues that it was necessary to debate on a wider scale, that there was great value in bringing them into a more public forum as far as possible, and out of... in addition to the debates that happen within the Pentagon and within government as part of the Nuclear Posture Review. And I think both the presentations we've heard this afternoon were pleasingly controversial. They certainly sparked a very, very good discussion going and were both very rich in the analytic detail that I know both Mike and Jeffrey have spent a long time working on and developing their arguments. So the final thing is just for me to thank them.